"How well you read me, you witch," interposed Mr. Rochester. "But what did you find in the veil besides its embroidery? Did you find poison or a dagger that you look so mournful now?"
"No, no, sir. Besides the delicacy and richness of the fabric, I found nothing save Fairfax Rochester's pride, and that did not scare me, because I am used to the sight of the demon. But, sir, as it grew dark, the wind rose. It blew yesterday evening, not as it blows now, wild and high, but with a sullen, moaning sound, far more eerie. I wished you were at home. I came into this room, and the sight of the empty chair and fireless hearth chilled me. For some time after I went to bed, I could not sleep. A sense of anxious excitement distressed me. The gale, still rising, seemed to my ear to muffle a mournful undersound. Whether in the house or abroad, I could not at first tell. But it recurred, doubtful yet doleful, at every lull. At last I made out it must be some dog howling at a distance. I was glad when it ceased. On sleeping, I continued in dreams the idea of a dark and gusty night. I continued also the wish to be with you, and experienced a strange, regretful consciousness of some barrier dividing us. During all my first sleep, I was following the windings of an unknown road. Total obscurity environed me. Rain pelted me. I was burdened with the charge of a little child, a very small creature, too young and feeble to walk, and which shivered in my cold arms and wailed piteously in my ear. I thought, sir, that you were on the road a long way before me, and I strained every nerve to overtake you, and made effort on effort to utter your name and entreat you to stop. But my movements were fettered, and my voice still died away inarticulate, while you, I felt, withdrew farther and farther every moment.
"And these dreams weigh on your spirits now, Jane, when I am close to you? Little nervous subject, forget visionary woe, and think only of real happiness. You say you love me, Janet. Yes, I will not forget that, and you cannot deny it. Those words did not die inarticulate on your lips. I heard them, clear and soft. A thought too solemn, perhaps, but sweet as music. I think it is a glorious thing to have the hope of living with you, Edward, because I love you. Do you love me, Jane? Repeat it."
"I do, sir. I do with my whole heart."
"Well," he said, after some minutes' silence, "it is strange, but that sentence has penetrated my breast painfully."
"Why?"
"I think because you said it with such an earnest, religious energy, and because your upward gaze at me now is the very sublime of faith, truth, and devotion. It is too much as if some spirit were near me. Look wicked, Jane, as you know well how to look. Coin one of your wild, shy, provoking smiles. Tell me you hate me, tease me, vex me. Do anything but move me. I would rather be incensed than saddened."
"I will tease you and vex you to your heart's content when I have finished my tale. But hear me to the end."
"I thought, Jane, you had told me all. I thought I had found the source of your melancholy in a dream."
I shook my head.
"What? Is there more? But I will not believe it to be anything important. I warn you of incredulity beforehand. Go on."
The disquietude of his air, the somewhat apprehensive impatience of his manner surprised me. But I proceeded. "I dreamt another dream, sir. That Thornfield Hall was a dreary ruin, the retreat of bats and owls. I thought that of all the stately front nothing remained but a shell-like wall, very high and very fragile-looking. I wandered on a moonlight night through the grass-grown enclosure within. Here I stumbled over a marble hearth, and there over a fallen fragment of cornice. Wrapped up in a shawl, I still carried the unknown little child. I might not lay it down anywhere, however tired were my arms, however much its weight impeded my progress. I must retain it. I heard the gallop of a horse at a distance on the road. I was sure it was you, and you were departing for many years and for a distant country. I climbed the thin wall with frantic, perilous haste, eager to catch one glimpse of you from the top. The stones rolled from under my feet. The ivy branches I grasped gave way. The child clung round my neck in terror and almost strangled me. At last I gained the summit. I saw you like a speck on a white track, lessening every moment. The blast blew so strong I could not stand. I sat down on the narrow ledge. I hushed the scared infant in my lap. You turned an angle of the road. I bent forward to take a last look. The wall crumbled. I was shaken. The child rolled from my knee. I lost my balance, fell, and woke. Now, Jane, that is all. All the preface, sir. The tale is yet to come. On waking, a gleam dazzled my eyes. I thought, oh, it is daylight. But I was mistaken. It was only candlelight. Sophie, I supposed, had come in. There was a light in the dressing-table, and the door of the closet where, before going to bed, I had hung my wedding dress and veil, stood open. I heard a rustling there. I asked, "Sophie, what are you doing?" No one answered, but a form emerged from the closet. It took the light, held it aloft, and surveyed the garments pendant from the portmanteau. "Sophie! Sophie!" I again cried, and still it was silent. I had risen up in bed. I bent forward. First surprise, then bewilderment came over me, and then my blood crept cold through my veins. Mr. Rochester, this was not Sophie, it was not Leah, it was not Mrs. Fairfax, it was not, no, I was sure of it, and am still, it was not even that strange woman, Grace Poole.
It must have been one of them, interrupted my master.
"No, sir. I solemnly assure you to the contrary. The shape standing before me had never crossed my eyes within the precincts of Thornfield Hall before. The height, the contour, were new to me.
Describe it, Jane."
"It seems, sir, a woman, tall and large, with thick and dark hair hanging long down her back. I know not what dress she had on. It was white and straight, but whether gown, sheet, or shroud, I cannot tell."
"Did you see her face?"
"Not at first, but presently she took my veil from its place. She held it up, gazed at it long, and then she threw it over her own head and turned to the mirror. At that moment I saw the reflection of the visage and features quite distinctly in the dark oblong glass."
"And how were they?"
"Fearful and ghastly to me. Oh, sir, I never saw a face like it. It was a discoloured face. It was a savage face. I wish I could forget the roll of the red eyes and the fearful blackened inflation of the lineaments.
Ghosts are usually pale, Jane."
"This, sir, was purple. The lips were swelled and dark, the brow furrowed, the black eyebrows widely raised over the bloodshot eyes. Shall I tell you of what it reminded me?"
"You may."
"Of the foul German spectre. The vampire."
"Ah! What did it do?"
"Sir, it removed my veil from its gaunt head, rent it in two parts, and flinging both on the floor, trampled on them."
"Afterwards?"
"It drew aside the window curtain and looked out. Perhaps it saw dawn approaching, for, taking the candle, it retreated to the door. Just at my bedside the figure stopped. The fiery eyes glared upon me. She thrust up her candle close to my face and extinguished it under my eyes. I was aware her lurid visage flamed over mine, and I lost consciousness. For the second time in my life, only the second time,
I became insensible from terror.
Who was with you when you revived?
No one, sir, but the broad day. I rose, bathed my head and face in water, drank a long draught, felt that though enfeebled I was not ill, and determined that to none but you would I impart this vision. Now, sir, tell me who and what that woman was.
The creature of an overstimulated brain, that is certain. I must be careful of you, my treasure. Nerves like yours were not made for rough handling.
Sir, depend on it, my nerves were not in fault. The thing was real, the transaction actually took place.
And your previous dreams, were they real too? Is Thornfield Hall a ruin? Am I severed from you by insuperable obstacles? Am I leaving you without a tear, without a kiss, without a word?
Not yet.
Am I about to do it? Why, the day is already commenced, which is to bind us indissolubly. And when we are once united, there shall be no recurrence of these mental terrors. I guarantee that.
Mental terror, sir. I wish I could believe them to be only such. I wish it more now than ever, since even you cannot explain to me the mystery of that awful visitant.
And since I cannot do it, Jane, it must have been unreal.
But, sir, when I said so to myself on rising this morning, and when I looked round the room to gather courage and comfort from the cheerful aspect of each familiar object in full daylight, there, on the carpet, I saw what gave the distinct lie to my hypothesis. The veil, torn from top to bottom in two halves.
I felt Mr. Rochester start and shudder. He hastily flung his arms round me.
"Thank God," he exclaimed, "that if anything malignant did come near you last night, it was only the veil that was harmed. Oh, to think what might have happened."
He drew his breath short and strained me, so close to him I could scarcely pant. After some minutes' silence, he continued cheerily.
"Now, Janet, I'll explain to you all about it. It was half dream, half reality. A woman did, I doubt not, enter your room, and that woman must have been Grace Poole. You call her a strange being yourself. From all you know, you have reason so to call her. What did she do to me? What to Mason? In a state between sleeping and waking, you noticed her entrance and her actions, but feverish, almost delirious as you were, you ascribed to her a goblin appearance different from her own. The long, disheveled hair, the swelled black face, the exaggerated stature were figments of imagination. Results of nightmare, the spiteful tearing of the veil was real, and it is like her. I see you would ask why I keep such a woman in my house when we have been married a year and a day. I will tell you, but not now. Are you satisfied, Jane? Do you accept my solution of the mystery?
I reflected, and in truth it appeared to me the only possible one. Satisfied I was not, but to please him I endeavoured to appear so. Relieved, I certainly did feel, so I answered him with a contented smile. And now, as it was long past one, I prepared to leave him.
"Does not Sophie sleep with Adele in the nursery?" he asked as I lit my candle.
"Yes, sir."
"And there is room enough in Adele's little bed for you. You must share it with her tonight, Jane. It is no wonder that the incident you have related should make you nervous, and I would rather you did not sleep alone. Promise me to go to the nursery."
"I shall be very glad to do so, sir."
"And fasten the door securely on the inside. Wake Sophie when you go upstairs under pretense of requesting her to rouse you in good time tomorrow, for you must be dressed and have finished breakfast before 8. And now, no more somber thoughts. Chase dull care away, Janet. Don't you hear to what soft whispers the wind has fallen? And there is no more beating of rain against the window panes. Look here." He lifted up the curtain. "It is a lovely night." It was.
Half heaven was pure and stainless. The clouds, now trooping before the wind, which had shifted to the west, were filing off eastward in long silvered columns. The moon shone peacefully.
"Well," said Mr. Rochester, gazing inquiringly into my eyes, "how is my Janet now?"
"The night is serene, sir, and so am I."
"And you will not dream of separation and sorrow tonight, but of happy love and blissful union."
This prediction was but half fulfilled. I did not indeed dream of sorrow, but as little did I dream of joy, for I never slept at all. With little Adele in my arms, I watched the slumber of childhood, so tranquil, so passionless, so innocent, and waited for the coming day. All my life was awake and astir in my frame, and as soon as the sun rose, I rose too. I remember Adele clung to me as I left her. I remember I kissed her as I loosened her little hands from my neck, and I cried over her with strange emotion, and quitted her because I feared my sobs would break her still sound repose. She seemed the emblem of my past life, and here I was now to array myself to meet the dread but adored type of my unknown future day.